good morning. Thanks for having us. I'm just going to start by sharing a true story with you. This really happened. The father of a kindergarten child found himself spending the night in jail. He was arrested for trespassing, and that all happened because he decided to stand up for his beliefs. His child was in a kindergarten classroom that was teaching that same-sex unions are equivalent to marriage. When he and his wife disagreed with that, it was adverse to their religious beliefs, he decided to approach the school and to tell them that he wanted his child to be removed from the classroom. Well, he wasn't given that opportunity, and after a series of meetings with the principal and the superintendent, he said, "I'm not leaving this school until you give me an opt-out option for my child." Well, he was denied that opportunity, and he was eventually arrested and taken to jail.
That's an example of what can happen right here in Minnesota if we're not successful in passing the marriage amendment. Once marriage begins to be redefined, individual liberties and freedom begin to decline. So that's why it is so important for us to engage the culture on this issue. We have a great example to look to as to how to do that. The Apostle Paul, we know, engaged the culture of his day as both a Roman and as a Christian. So there were times when he asserted the rights that he had as a Roman citizen, and there were also times that he tailored his message to a secular audience. So our goal here today with this presentation is to share with you the secular and the legal arguments for defining marriage as the union of one man and one woman. Now, I personally believe that there are religious reasons for defining marriage that way, and I think those reasons are sufficient. But I also recognize that in conversations with some people, they'll shut down if that's what you rely on. So sometimes it helps to complement that discussion with legal and social arguments. So that's what we're here to do today. And the other thing that we're here to do today is to show you how a redefinition of marriage really can and will impact you.
So before we get into the main details of the presentation, we're just going to lay out here what we are arguing and what we're not arguing. So what we are arguing is that marriage is a reality that unites a man and a woman and any children born from that union. We're arguing that marriage is a child-centered institution. It's about what kids need, not what adults want. And that redefining marriage severs the connection between children and their parents, and it also redefines parenthood. I mean, putting us in a position where we might have three people on a birth certificate. That's just unbelievable. And kids do best when raised in an intact home by their biological mother and father. And as we'll get into show you, social science data really does show that. Now, here today, especially as Christians, this is what we're not arguing. We're not arguing that people with same-sex attraction are bad or not worthy of love and respect. We're not arguing that gay or lesbian people hurt children. And we're not arguing that people with same-sex attraction are bad parents. And we're certainly not arguing that kids raised in a broken home or adoptive homes are doomed to fail. Now, this is the distinct difference that you need to draw your attention to. There's a difference between having a broken home as a result of a death or an unfortunate separation in the family, as opposed to the government starting from the premise of something that is less than ideal. And less than ideal is not having your biological mother and father promoted by the government.
So we're gonna hit three main topics here today. First, we're going to talk about why government is in the marriage business. Why does the state care about marriage? Then we're going to talk about how marriage right here in Minnesota is currently being weakened both in law and in culture. And finally, we're going to show through real examples from around the country how a redefinition of marriage will impact you and restrict your individual freedom. So let's start. Why is government in the marriage business? Why does the state care about marriage? The state does not care about friendships, right? You don't need a license from the state to have a friend. And when you decide that you no longer want to be that person's friends, you do not need the state's permission to dissolve that friendship. You don't need to divorce your friend. So what's different about marriage? Why does government care about marriage? Let's walk through this. We know that the union between a man and a woman has the unique ability to create new life. There's no other relationship on the planet that can create new life. We know this. We also know that new life is vulnerable and in need of protection. The man and the woman who created that new life are typically best at guiding that new life and protecting that new life. This is borne out by a wide range of social science data, as Renee just said. This is a research brief put out by Child Trends. It's a nonpartisan research institute. It was put out a few years ago. And it right in the first page, it says, an extensive body of research tells us that children do best when they grow up with both biological parents in a low-conflict marriage. The study continues on and says, it's not simply the presence of two parents, but rather the presence of two biological parents that seem to support children's development. So this shows us that children do best when raised by their biological mother and father. Marriage, then, is the only institution that we have in our society that unites the biological, legal, and social aspects of parenthood in a lasting bond. This is why government cares about marriage. They care about the next generation of citizens. Congress, back in 1996, said it very simply. Simply put, government has an interest in marriage because it has an interest in children. Another way to say this is to say that marriage connects the mother and the father with the child that they create. We also believe that men and women are equally necessary to the task of parenting. Moms don't make good dads, and dads don't make good moms. I'm not the only one who believes that. The UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, Article 7, says, "The child shall have the right to know and be cared for by his or her parents." Our state law also recognizes that this is the right definition of marriage.
Now, as Evan mentioned, we do see that affirmation in state law. We see that in four basic ways. We see that state law affirms marriage is based on sexual union, it's exclusive, it's presumptively procreative, and it's also presumptively permanent. And the details of that are the following. First of all, civil marriage does involve sexual union. Marriage outright is a civil contract between a man and a woman. However, under Minnesota Statute 518.02, Minnesota law says that a party who lacks the physical capacity to consummate the marriage by sexual intercourse and the other party at the time the marriage was solemnized did not know of that capacity does have the right to annul the marriage. In addition to that, marriage is certainly exclusive. It is still on the books as a crime in Minnesota to commit adultery as well as bigamy. Marriage is presumed to be procreative in that we know that a married man is legally presumed to be the father of any children conceived or born to the wife during the marriage or 280 days thereafter. And so basically this is telling us that even civil law recognizes that man plus woman very well likely equals baby. And in addition to that, this shows us that the civil law also has an importance of creating dads who are going to foster the well-being of their children, that civil law cares that dads be responsible for these children. And finally, civil law is certainly presumed to be permanent in that one cannot just go out and get a divorce anytime that they want to without the court's consent. You can't simply divide up your belongings, leave the area, and say, okay, we're done. You must go through the courts. You must sign documents to be legally divorced or you will be committing a crime.
So let's move on and talk about how currently in Minnesota, marriage as an institution is being weakened in both law and culture. First, we have falling marriage rates. Minnesota has the fourth lowest marriage rate in the United States. Only three states with lower marriage rates are Delaware, Mississippi, and New Jersey. The marriage rate in Minnesota declined 42% between 1980 and 2010. Divorce is another factor that's weakening the institution of marriage. Here in Minnesota, every 35 minutes, a couple divorces in Minnesota. There's one divorce for every 1.65 marriages. Cohabitation is also undermining marriage. Cohabitation has increased 17-fold since 1980. A result of that is out-of-wedlock births. Currently in Minnesota, 1/3 of all children born are born to single mothers. that's 33.33% of all children born here in Minnesota are born to single moms. That's up from 2.3% in 1950. A related interesting statistic here shows that this is not just a result of teenage pregnancy. Only 5% of those births are born to women under the ages of 18. 75% of those births are born to women between the ages of 18 and 29. One other statistic we have that's fascinating, we don't have up here, is that 85% of all abortions performed in Minnesota are performed on single women. So if we just changed the marriage culture, think of the dramatic effect that would have on the abortion rate. Poverty. As this graph shows, some 33.2% of single mothers with children are poor, compared with 3.8% of married couples with children. Another way to say this is to say that single-parent families with children are almost 9 times as likely to be poor as married families. This is another facet that tells us why government has an interest in marriage. Because once marriage breaks down, it imposes significant costs on society and on individuals. This is one example of how that happens.
Now, you probably hear a lot of people saying, well, what does it matter to me? And it's my personal decision. But as Evan has been saying, we need to stand up for marriage because the cultural erosion of marriage is so prevalent. Marriage based on love and fidelity is being replaced by imposters that just aren't marriage and just aren't sufficient to take on the duty that marriage does have. As we talked about earlier, cohabitation is becoming more prevalent. And even effortless divorce is just taking over, unfortunately, the institution of marriage. The inseparable bond between marriage, sex, procreation, and childbearing is becoming lost. Now, with respect to same-sex unions, the crisis in marriage does not result from same-sex attraction. It's not completely their fault. The crisis in marriage results from disconnecting marriage and procreation. One way to look at that would be taking the example of driver's licenses. Many people in this room are probably married, I'm assuming, and many of you likely have driver's licenses as well. But your driver's license has nothing to do with your marriage. Well, if we start putting into law the idea of same-sex unions, we're going to have just that. We're going to have these free licenses for marriage that have nothing to do with marriage and the purpose of marriage itself. Before I go to the next slide, I'd kind of like to take a survey of hands here. How many people think that in Minnesota, more than 20% of the people are in same-sex unions raising children right now? How many believe that, let me rephrase that. In Minnesota, same-sex couple households is the number we'll be looking at next. I just want to get an idea of how many Minnesota same-sex households you might think are in existence. And do you think there's more than 20%, or maybe around 20%? Raise your hand. How about 10% or so? Anyone think less than 5%? And the answer to that question is there are less than 1% of same-sex households in Minnesota. There are over 1 million husband and wife households in Minnesota. This is coming from 2010 U.S. Census data. So again, what this tells us is that whole drive to convince us that this is so prevalent, that this is taking over, that this is the way that society is going and you should turn that way too, that's not truth. Look at the U.S. Census data. And to that, Minnesota same-sex households, only about 2,000 of those same-sex households are raising minor children, according to the U.S. Census data. And 80% of those children were born to one of the partners prior to that engagement. That's from the UCLA Williams Institute study. So this is valid information. Again, that idea that this is so prevalent, times are changing, you got to run with the times and agree with it. That's not the truth. One, that's not truth as a Christian. And two, that's just not practical truth. And to that, we'll move on to the proposed amendment and how this amendment will prevent the redefinition of marriage by courts and politicians.
So this is the ballot question. When you go to vote in November, this is the question you will actually see on the ballot. Shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to provide that only a union of one man and one woman shall be valid or recognized as marriage in Minnesota? Why do we need this? As Renee showed earlier, our existing state law already affirms this. So isn't that good enough? Why do we need to amend our state constitution to protect marriage? This is why. That existing law is currently being challenged in Hennepin County, in our state court system. This is an active case, Benson versus Alverson. It is moving through the court system now. It was brought by several same-sex couples against the Hennepin County Registrar who refused to marry them because they did not meet the requirements under state law to get married. So the same-sex couples sued. The trial court in the case initially dismissed it and said, our Minnesota Supreme Court already addressed this question back in 1971 in a case called Baker versus Nelson, which held that defining marriage as the union of one man and one woman does not violate the U.S. Constitution. So initially, the trial court dismissed the case. The plaintiffs appealed, and these three judges on the Minnesota Court of Appeals said that the trial court was wrong in ruling that Baker versus Nelson decided the case because it only addressed rights under the U.S. Constitution. So the Court of Appeals told the trial court to go back and reconsider whether the definition of marriage that we have in our existing state law today violates rights under the Minnesota Constitution. So this case is moving forward. There was a hearing in it just 2 weeks ago. It's moving through the court system. A constitutional amendment, therefore, is necessary to prevent our state court judges from striking down state law based on some right that they create under the Minnesota Constitution. If you don't think that's a probability, we just have to look south of us to Iowa. This is exactly what happened in Iowa. Back in 1996, the Iowa legislature passed a law defining marriage as the union of one man and one woman. It's very similar to Minnesota's existing law. In 2005, same-sex couples sued, challenging that law. Ultimately, the Iowa Supreme Court agreed and said, you know, we think under the Iowa Constitution that same-sex couples should have access to marriage. So today in Iowa, same-sex marriage is legal, and there's nothing that the voters have been able to do to change that. That could happen here through this case if we do not amend our Constitution this November. And that's one of the reasons that this amendment could not come at a better time. Another reason we need to put this in our state constitution is because recently there have been legislative attempts to redefine marriage. Just this last session, there were two bills introduced that would have done so. House File 1710 would have created gender-neutral marriage. Section 8 of the bill said, the reviser shall change any terms that specifically refer to husband or wife or male or female in the context of a marriage relationship to the gender-neutral term spouse. House File 1746 would have eliminated marriage altogether and replaced it with civil unions for everybody. So the question isn't really, will marriage be defined in Minnesota? And the question isn't really even, will marriage be defined in our state constitution? The question is, who will define it in our state constitution? Will it be we the people through our votes, or will we leave it up to a handful of judges or legislators? So if we're successful in passing the amendment, what will it do, what will it not do? It will not take away the right to visit a loved one in the hospital. This is clearly established federal guidelines. Hospitals cannot deny visitation rights to same-sex couples. This is not an issue. The amendment will not change that. The amendment, if we pass it, will not deny equal access to employment, housing, or the basic necessities of life. It will not prevent same-sex couples from entering into relationships with each other. It will not prevent them from celebrating that relationship. It will not prevent them from living together. In fact, it will not change anything at all for same-sex couples that they have today. It will have no effect. So what will it do? It will confirm in our law that marriage and childbearing are in fact related. and it will assure that children are legally and socially connected to their mom and dad. It will maintain control of this question in the hands of the voters. This doesn't mean that we can't ever change this in society at some point in the future if we shall choose to do so. We can go through this same process. But what it forces is to keep that process and that control of the definition of marriage in the hands of the voters.
Now, the dangers of redefining marriage are that people or groups defining marriage of one man and one woman will be punished, something that I'm sure many of you are aware of. We've seen this in the news recently. The position that marriage is the legal union of one man and one woman is already being publicly condemned by high public profile figures. Now, we move to the example of Chick-fil-A. That's the infamous example, so it seems. It's been on the news continuously. And the same thing stands no matter what the end result is with the most recent talk about what's going on with Chick-fil-A and Dan Cathy and what he said about their promotion of family values. It doesn't change the fact that at a period in time, the San Francisco mayor, the Chicago mayor, and the Boston mayor all told their city councils not to let Chick-fil-A build there. They said to deny them the zoning permits that they needed to have that business there because they promoted values that were family values, traditional marriage values, and were not the values of those cities. So you can see that, again, the high public profile figures are certainly putting pressure in many areas. As we mentioned earlier in the opening of the presentation, public education resources promoting the moral equivalency of same-sex unions and marriages is already prevalent, and this view is being forced at all grade levels. Again, we are talking about a kindergartner. In this example, the case is Parker v. Hurley, where this father spent the night in jail because he didn't want his kindergartner to be learning about same-sex unions and being told that that was equivalent to marriage.
I'm just going to add on to that real quickly. That example, Mr. Parker's night in jail, happened 15 months after the state courts in Massachusetts made same-sex marriage legal. So it took the public education system 15 months to begin promoting same-sex unions as equivalent to marriage in kindergarten class.
I mean, good point, Evan. You just need the green light, and they're going to run with it. This curriculum is already there and ready to go. And public officials are already denying access to public facilities, funding, and programs to those groups who disagree with homosexual marriage. One such example of that would be the Boy Scouts. You've seen this for a number of years where the Boy Scouts are being denied certain uses, especially having licenses revoked for uses of public lands and parkways. That's an example of a case called Barnes v. Wallace, where the Boy Scouts, again, were denied the use of a publicly leased land because they were not proponents of same-sex unions. And finally, public officials will revoke tax-exempt status of those who disagree. Those words are just frightening and unfathomable to me. I can't believe that those freedoms are actually being sacrificed with what's going on here. In Ocean Grove Camp Meeting Association of the United States Methodist Church v. Papaleo, we saw that. This was a camp organization that held a lot of Judeo-Christian values and still does. And what they said is that they did not want their land to be used and offered up for a same-sex union under their pavilion. And they said that that went against their rights and their beliefs. Well, eventually, as this case went through the system in the state, their tax-exempt status was revoked because they weren't proponents of same-sex unions or allowing their facilities to be used for such. And again, they weren't allowing that because it was against their beliefs. So this is certainly infringing on our freedoms.
A couple other examples here. Public employees who disagree will be subject to discipline, demotion, and even termination. This is what happened to Gerald Buell. He was a Florida High School Teacher of the Year, but he was removed from his classroom because on his personal Facebook page, he had posted comments opposing same-sex unions. He was only reinstated after significant public pressure and threatening to sue. Another example is Ron Brown. Ron Brown was rejected for a coaching job at Stanford University because back in 1999, on a radio program, he had expressed Orthodox Christian views about homosexuality. 6, private businesses will be subjected to fines and penalties for violation of anti-discrimination laws. This is what happened to Elaine and her husband. Elaine and her husband own a small photography business in New Mexico. One day, Elaine was approached by a same-sex couple who asked her to photograph their commitment ceremony. Elaine politely declined because doing so would have conflicted with her religious beliefs. So the same-sex couple went to the New Mexico Human Rights Commission complaining against Elaine. The commission ultimately ended up fining Elaine and her husband thousands of dollars in costs for violating an anti-discrimination law. 7, private and religious charities will be forced to choose between serving those in need and promoting an idea that they oppose. This had real consequences for Catholic Charities out in Boston. Catholic Charities have been running an adoption agency since 1903. They successfully placed between 30 and 40 children each year into homes. But in 2006, they announced that they would close their adoption agency rather than comply with state law that would have forced them to place children in same-sex homes. So who is this affecting? Well, in that case, it's affecting not only the religious rights of religious organizations, it's also affecting the rights of children. 8, individuals will be denied professional licensure or discipline for disagreement. This is what happened to both Julia Ward and Jennifer Keaton. Julia Ward was a student pursuing a degree in social work at Eastern Michigan University. The university had a policy requiring its students to affirm homosexual conduct in any counseling situations. Well, during a practicum course, Ms. Ward was assigned someone who was seeking counseling for their same-sex relationship. Knowing that this would conflict with her religious beliefs, Ms. Ward asked her supervisor how to handle the situation. The supervisor said, refer the client to someone else who can provide them the counsel that they're looking for. So that's what Ms. Ward did, but unfortunately, the university initiated a proceeding against her and ordered her to participate in remediation training. When Ms. Ward refused, she was expelled from the school. Jennifer Keaton has a similar story. She was pursuing a master's degree in counseling at Augusta State University. She was told that her religiously informed beliefs about gender and sexuality conflicted with a professional requirement of multicultural competence. So she, too, was asked to go through remediation training. One of the suggestions of the training was that she attend a gay pride parade and report back to the school on how that affected her personal beliefs. She sued to prevent the school from expelling her if she refused to participate in that remediation training, but unfortunately, she lost her case. So where is this heading? This is a statement from Vincent Gray, who's the mayor of Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C., the city of Washington, D.C., denied its citizens the right to vote on this question, even though the Constitution of D.C. required them to put this question to the voters. The city said, no, we're not going to do that. This is what the mayor said. When people don't support marriage equality, it is the law here in the District of Columbia. People who don't support human rights for everybody, there is just no place for them in this city. This is what the future can look like here in Minneapolis. This is what a current or future political leader of Minneapolis might say about you if we are not successful in protecting marriage. Notice a couple other things here. Notice how he uses the terms equality, human rights. These are a severe abuse of these terms. Same-sex couples do not want equality. They do not want equal access to marriage. How do I know this? Because they have equal access to marriage. Same-sex couples can marry just like you and I and anyone else here can marry, but they have to meet the same requirements that you and I and everyone else has to meet. Notice one other thing. You've probably seen the vote no signs around the city. The slogan on them says, don't limit the freedom to marry. At worst, using freedom in that context is a severe abuse of the notion of freedom. At best, it's wrong and it's misleading. Why? Because, of course, we have certain restrictions on marriage. Freedom is not completely unbounded, right? You can't marry a 12-year-old. You can't marry your sister or brother. You can't marry your father or mother. You can't marry someone who's already married to someone else. We call that bigamy. We have these restrictions on marriage. We define marriage in this way because it serves the common good. Freedom needs to be balanced with how it serves the common good. That's what protecting the definition of marriage does. As we spent the first part of the presentation showing, defining marriage between a man and a woman serves the common good because, among other things, it provides a stable and nurturing environment for children. Notice also how he uses the word human rights here. To the extent, you can't just call anything you want to do a human right and make it so. That's not how this works. To the extent that human rights are raised in this debate, I would argue that it's the human rights of children. As I mentioned earlier, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child says that the child shall have the right to know and be cared for by his or her mother or father. Let's move on here. So if we amend our state constitution to define marriage, what about the U.S. Constitution? Isn't there some right in the U.S. Constitution that will trump this and it won't really be of any effect? The answer is no. No federal court has ever found a right to same-sex marriage under the U.S. Constitution. In fact, the very liberal Ninth Circuit did not even find a right under the U.S. Constitution. This is the Proposition 8 case out of California, Perry versus Brown. Here's a quote from that case. Whether under the Constitution same-sex couples may ever be denied the right to marry, a right that has long been enjoyed by opposite-sex couples, is an important and highly controversial question. We need not and do not answer that broader question in this case. And on the other hand, we do have federal courts who have affirmed that there is no right to redefine marriage under the U.S. Constitution. This is a case out of Hawaii, Jackson versus Abercrombie. It was decided by a federal judge about 5 weeks ago. This case was a challenge to Hawaii state law that defines marriage between a man and a woman. In this case, the federal judge actually looked back at the Minnesota Supreme Court decision in 1971, Baker versus Nelson, which had made its way up to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court dismissed it, and at that time, that constituted a decision on the merits. So this judge in this case said that Baker versus Nelson still controls this question. Baker versus Nelson found that there was no right to redefine marriage under the U.S. Constitution. And alternatively, this judge said that there is a rational basis for Hawaii to define marriage between a man and a woman.
All that to say that for those of you who think that the Constitution will protect you, unfortunately, we've got to think again. The free exercise in the First Amendment will not be accepted as valid grounds for disagreement. How do we know that? We look to a case called Employment Division v. Smith, a 1990 U.S. Supreme Court case. The language of that case is as follows. The government's ability to enforce generally applicable prohibitions of socially harmful conduct, like its ability to carry out other aspects of public policy, cannot depend on measuring the effects of governmental action on a religious objector's spiritual development. What does that mean? In other words, in states that have redefined marriage, the court will describe acting on our definition of marriage as socially harmful conduct and rule that punishing us for our conduct cannot depend on the effect on our religious beliefs. That's why we're here today. That's why we're here on this issue of marriage. As Evan stated, not only is it truth personally for both of us as strongly convicted Christians, but it just practically makes sense. And it is our prayer that this presentation has been an avenue to show you so that you can have discourse with others and even tell them about why God's truth is so, why marriage is what it is. Not only is it biblically accurate, it's practically truthful, consistent with this presentation. That's why we're here urging you to vote yes and telling you why failing to vote is actually a no vote. If you say anything to anyone, please leave them with this. According to the Minnesota Constitution, if you vote no, if you fail to vote, you're essentially voting no. That's because if a majority of all the electors voting at the election vote to ratify an amendment, it becomes part of the Constitution. And how can you stand up and take a stand? Listen to these inspiring words by Martin Luther King. On some positions, a coward has been asked the question, is it safe? Expediency asks the question, is it politic? Vanity asks the question, is it popular? But conscience asks the question, is it right? And there come a time when one must take a position that is neither safe, nor politic, nor popular, but he must take it because his conscience tells him that it is right.
So how can you help? MinnesotaForMarriage.com has a fantastic website with a lot of truthful information. They've got a myths and fact section, which is really good. We have a bunch of brochures out here on the table. Feel free to take what you need after the service, and we'll be around to answer any questions you might have. There's a couple other things you can do. I know that the campaign is really trying to gear up its phone banking. They're really stressing the importance of making phone calls. So you can go to their headquarters or other places that they have, and it's very easy to do. I would encourage you to equip yourself with the truthful information from this website that we've given you here today and from the brochures, and be respectfully bold when you engage others in conversations about this. Do not let others attempt to silence you. It's un-American to try to silence you for your beliefs. Be respectfully bold and share your beliefs with others. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, "Silence in the face of evil is itself evil." God will not hold us guiltless. Not to speak is to speak. Not to act is to act. So please respectfully share your view of this with others and vote yes in November. Don't leave it blank. Thank you.